Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of Under the Radar SFF Books Podcast. I'm your host, Blaze, as always. Thank you so much for listening and joining wherever you may be around the world. And today we're doing another episode of my new series, The Four Pillars of Writing. And today we're talking about the prose in any type of fantasy and sci-fi story. And I'm joined by fantasy author Delilah Wan, author of Petition, which is book one in the Resonance Crystal Legacy. Delilah, welcome to the program, and thank you so much for hopping on.
Thank you so much. I'm very excited to be here.
Of course, anytime. So when we talk about the four pillars of writing, from my perspective, and you let me know if you agree or not, I think of characters, I think of world building, I think of plot, and I think of prose. And I must say, as the years have gone on, I've grown to love and appreciate prose more and more, just as I get older. How would you describe prose in terms of the language and how that relates to fantasy and science fiction stories?
Oh, this is a really tricky one. I think I would generally agree with the four pillars that you've identified. But I think prose for me stands a little bit separately from the other three. And the reason being is when you consider that what we're talking about, a work of prose fiction, by definition, it does not exist without the prose, right? And so the prose is one of those things where I don't think you can have any of the other three pillars without considering how that is going to impact your choice of prose. The prose is something that you can't consider it as a standalone pillar by itself, because whatever you're doing in the prose, it's got to be doing something for the character, the setting, and the plot itself. Otherwise, I think you end up losing the thing that makes the prose important.
Yeah, I guess I would agree with that. You're thinking of it as more like, if you're talking about characters or certain types of like the plot, the movement, and the like the journey for people to get to some place, it just elevates it. And we'll talk a little bit about the elevated prose. I know you and myself. One of my favorite authors does that. Jenny Wirtz does that to like the nth degree. Mm-hmm. And in my opinion, there's no one else who does it better. But that's interesting. And what about the prose, or your definition of prose? Did you want to kind of bring to like your own writing, or how did you go about wanting to incorporate that into Petition specifically?
So I've got, I have one philosophy on prose, right? And that comes down to the fact that every single sentence I write has one job and one job only, and that is to convince the target reader for my book to read the next sentence, right? And an entire novel is just basically made out of sentences. So if I succeed in writing a sentence that makes them want to read the next one, eventually, as long as I don't lose them somewhere along the way, they will read the whole book. And if I've done a good job of structuring those sentences into arcs that make sense for the book and the story that I'm going to tell, they're going to want to read the next book. And so it is for me something that when I sit down to write prose, I'm not deliberately trying to use any particular style. What I'm thinking about as I sit down to write the prose is, what am I trying to do with this sentence? What is it that I want the reader to feel, to think? And where am I trying to take them on this particular story?
Got it. Noted. And all throughout my reading experience and discovering just the magnificent job that authors have done with prose over the years, I wonder, what was your first experience reading a book and you say, wow, this sentence structure, this story, this writing is so rich and vivid that I just can't get enough of it? When was that first like aha moment for you?
Oh, this is very clear for me. So I, for the longest time, right, I did not really get what everybody was talking about when they talked about prose. I was just like, oh, I don't understand what you mean. Do you mean it's just all the flowery, literary kind of stylistic stuff, you know, that you get in lit fic, or that you get in, you know, older works of fantasy like Tolkien's work, stuff like that? And I was just a bit confused by it all. So I would hear all these people going on about prose, but It didn't really click for me until I read Seth Dickinson's blog article, which is titled Let's Hurt Sentences. And I don't know that it's a widely known article, but I think it was the thing that really flipped that light switch on me because he wrote it during his line edit stage while he was writing The Traitor Baro Cormorant, which is one of my favorite fantasy books ever. And he was talking about how for him, the prose needs to do at least two things, right? So every sentence has the job of conveying what is happening immediately in the story, but that sentence should also be shaded and written with a secondary purpose in mind. So each sentence, if you're writing in something like a deep third POV, when you read a sentence from any character's perspective, that sentence should be written such that it reveals a little bit about what's going on in the scene, but also what that character is thinking or feeling or perceiving in that moment in a way that it can only come from that particular character. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think it does. And Seth Dickinson, I'm glad you actually brought him up because I remember reading The Traitor Baro Cormorant a while ago, and it didn't hit me at first that it was a fantasy story because it's one, there's no magic, and it's a political thriller and a political, in some cases, a political tragedy. What's going on? But I do love his writing. It just took me a long time to get really invested in the plot. You know what I mean with the first book?
Oh yeah, he's got a very strong prose style, and I know other readers such as Patrick Leo just did not get on with Seth Dickinson's prose style. But for me, I really love it. I would describe his style as it's very incisive, and he writes in the Baro books particularly. He writes in a very it's a very restrained way. There is a lot of deep character work going on, but it's very subtle, and you have to be looking for it. You have to be passing through the subtext, because if you don't, then a lot of those inner shifts in the characters' emotions, in what they're trying to do, in their intentions and their plans, you will miss it, because he will not come out and say it to you on the page, except when he does on the very first page before you start reading the books. But he does it in a way that is it's very layered, and so you often don't realize what you've read until you've read it. And then as you're reading, you think back to what he's written before, and then you go, oh, that was what was going on. And that is a part of why I love his writing so much. But definitely the Baro books, I would say, you probably don't lean into that fantasy aspect until probably the second book. The second book is where it gets a little bit more fantastical.
Well, then I have to do a reread of that. I have the first two books in my library, so definitely got to do that. It sounds a lot like Wars of Light and Shadow by Jenny Wirtz, where you don't know what you're reading until it actually hits you. And then when you read back, he's like, aha, she said it all along. You just didn't catch up the first time.
Oh, it's amazing.
I love stories like that. So I see that you have a little book pile next to you. So we're definitely going to go into some examples of prose. I'm kind of curious, what do you want to share with us today?
Oh, okay. So while we're on the subject of Jenny Wirtz, so one of her, she's got so many books which are just absolutely fantastic, and I would love to draw on some of the examples of, you know what, let's actually do start with The Wars of Light and Shadow since we've been talking about it. And I want to kind of dive straight into an example here because I think it's really illustrative of something that manifests in the prose itself. So if we take The Wars of Light and Shadow and the character of, and I did not read these on audiobooks, so I'm probably going to mispronounce all the names, Arathon, who is one of the main characters. Arathon is he is musically trained, right? And so there is this moment in The Curse of the Mistwraith where he has not picked up an instrument for a very long time. And they're, you know, there's sort of this party, they're traveling through the wilderness, there's a bard there, he's got a lyranth, which is a 14, it's a 14-stringed lute, essentially, that is unique to the world of the Wars of Light and Shadow. And Arathorn picks it up and plays something for the first time. And to contrast that scene, there is, we've all probably heard of Patrick Rothfuss's Name of the Wind, which I have not personally read. I have just read certain excerpts from it and a few other people's analyses of it. But there is also a very similar scene in which, is it Quoth? Is that how you pronounce his name?
Quoth, yep.
Quoth, yeah. In which Quoth picks up also a lute for the first time. And I personally think it's very interesting to compare and contrast how these two very different authors with very different prose styles in very different narratives, I would say, write the prose in that same moment. And so if we look at the relevant excerpt from The Name of the Wind, I'll just read the first paragraph here. This is written in first person. I touched the last string and tuned it to ever so slightly. I made a simple chord and strummed it. It rang soft and true. I moved a finger and the chord went minor in a way that always sounded to me as if the lute were saying sad. I moved my hands again and the lute made two chords whispering against each other. Then, without realizing what I was doing, I began to play. So that's from The Name of the Wind. Now, this is Jani Wirtz writing The Curse of the Mistwraith. And this is a little bit different because she uses third person omniscient in this passage. And so we're not in Arathorn's head as he is doing this, but we are third person omniscient, but zoomed in on the bard who has loaned him the instrument. His movements as he lifted the soundboard to his shoulder were recognizably reverent. Arathorn poised tentative fingers, sounded a shower of practiced harmonics, and found an interval off. He corrected the pitch neatly and precisely. When he looked up, his eyes were laughing. And what I think is so interesting about those two different passages is in both cases, right, you have a narrator of the scene who is an expert musician, I would say. And yet, I think in how the authors construct the actual prose of those passages, you can really see a difference between the fact that Jani Wirtz must be a musician herself in the vocabulary she uses, in how she describes the physical actions of the characters, and that depth of subject matter expertise in this particular situation really comes through for me in a way that the Rothfuss passage doesn't.
That's a great two passages to compare and contrast between Name of the Wind and Curse of the Mistwraith. Two things I wanted to touch base on. Well, in case you listeners are wondering, one copied the other. So Curse of the Mistwraith was published in 1993. The Name of the Wind was published in 2007. So you have a big time gap in between them. It was written in different styles. Number two, that passage from, The Curse of the Mistwraith. I can tell how much influence Jani had on you and your writing. And specifically, when it comes to petition, I need to ask, how much of The Wars of Land and Shadow was influenced by this? Because in your book, you do a lot of augury and do a lot of foreshadowing, which is very much related to one character in Wars of Light and Shadow, Dakar, who I love, and also the resonance crystals themselves. So I gotta ask, just because I'm a fan nerd, how much influence came from Jani Wirtz and Wars of Light and Shadow?
Oh my goodness, this is such a difficult question to answer, because the actual incident that I thought people were going to ask me about, which they have not, is when I was trying to come up with comparable titles for Petition, because you need the comparable title to intrigue people to read your book. I said it was Daughter of the Empire meets the traitor Borrow Cormorant in a cage match between empaths. And what I thought everybody was going to ask me about was, did you base your magic system on that one scene at the end of the Daughter of the Empire where the magicians do a thing, and that is basically how the entire plot wraps up. And interestingly enough, I would have to say, when I came up with the idea for Petition, I'm always one of those writers who I never thought I had like a burning story to write. Like, I've always been one of those people, I love writing stories, I love creating and storytelling, but every single time that someone was like, oh, okay, so like one day, like if you write a novel, what is that story going to be about? And I'd be like, I don't know. I just know I want to write a novel someday. And so I actually had the idea for the magic system for Petition First, and it came out of, I was doing a lot of reading about the blockchain for work, and it's actually like the mechanics of it is actually based on blockchain. And then somewhere along the way, I kind of had this light bulb moment of, oh, like it would be so much more interesting if the magic system wasn't just about, okay, because I started with the kernel of the thought, which was, what if there was such a thing as an objective truth, right? Because I feel like in today's day and age, we're kind of, most people are accepting of the worldview that there is no such thing as an absolute truth. It's truth as filtered through an individual's experience of the world. And so I was kind of thinking, well, okay, well, if the blockchain's entire purpose is like, okay, this, you know, this, untamperable record, that concept, if that concept could be applied to the truth, like what would that look like? How would a world like that function? And somewhere along the way of the writing process, it morphed a little bit away from that. And we got into the concept of emotions echoing through time. And that was really the mechanic of how the whole blockchain being transformed into the magic system. But honestly, I have read a lot of Jenny Wirtz throughout my formative years. Like every single time I would go to the library, I went straight to the W section just so I could see which of her books were on the shelf. And so it is probably unavoidable the extent to which her works have seeped into my own writing. But I would never say that anything like outright was you know inspired by it, because The way I kind of regard Jenny Wirtz's books, it's like they're just these great works of literature that belong on the same shelf as Tolkien's. And I'm just like, if I can somehow, you know, give people the same feeling that I got when I read any of her books, like that is mission accomplished for me. But I yeah. Sorry, that was a very long and rambling answer, but I just love her books so much.
No, that was wonderful. And hopefully with the release for the audiobook for Curse of the Mistwraith, people will finally get to hear and see what we've been known for many years now. Mm-hmm. So you were able to give us a couple lovely quotes. I thought I would give one of myself. So this one is from one of my favorite books, fantasy books that I've ever read. This is from Tigana, written by Guy Gavrielke. And for those of you listening who may not know who Guy Gavrielke is, he helped J.R.R. Tolkien's son write the Silmarillion. So he's very well versed in like brilliant prose and a brilliant storyteller. So this is from the prologue. I'm just going to read the first few pages. Both moons were high, dimming the light of all but the brightest stars. The campfires burned on either side of the river, stretching away into the night, quietly flowing. The Daesa caught the moonlight and the orange of the nearer fires and cast them back in wavery, sinuous ripples. And all the lines of light led to his eyes, to where he was sitting on the riverbank, hands about his knees, thinking about dying and the life he'd lived. There was a glory to the night. Sevar thought, breathing deeply of the mild summer air, smelling water and water flowers and grass, watching the reflection of blue moonlight and silver on the river, hearing the Deus's murmurs flow and the distant singing from around the fires. There was singing on the other side of the river too. Listening to the enemy soldiers north of them, it was curiously hard to input any absolute sense of evil to those harmonizing voices, or to hate them quiet as blinding as being a soldier seemed to require. He wasn't a real soldier though, and he had never been good at hating. So a little bit of background to that. So the kingdom of Tigana, or the continent of Tigana, is being invaded by a foreign empire, and they're trying to take over. So it's Sevar, he's a soldier, and he's singing, he's hearing these voices harmonizing and singing across the river. Those are his enemies. But he realizes that it's also, there's beauty in what they're singing and the humanity of it. And it makes you reflect on the horrors that war brings to people who have things in common, but they're just maybe on different sides of the line, and just how I thought that was a beautiful way to open up the book, and that's just a little taste of what the story does, and it's just wonderful. Guy Gavrielke. Have you read anything by Guy Gavrielke?
I have not, and it is one of my biggest regrets. He has been on my TBR for an eternity, and I have got to get to him soon.
Well, he has my highest recommendations for that. I see you have some other books there. What other quotes you got for us?
I am going to pick something from J.B. Jones's A Cavern of Black Ice, which is the first book in her epic fantasy, Sword of Shadows. I guess you could describe it as grimdark. To be honest, I always have trouble like pinning down what exactly is grimdark. But J.B. Jones to me is a writer who, like the amount of emotional devastation that I went through, just with one of her books, and then with each successive one has been wild. So I have picked a passage from, it's quite early on in A Cavern of Black Ice, and it is from the perspective of Azaria March, also known as Ash March, who is she kind of starts out as your standard chosen one. With an inversion. So there is a prophecy about her, but she is prophesied to be the one who destroys the world, essentially. She's the apocalypse bringer. So right now, I'm gonna pick up just before she just before she is, oh, let's see, where are we? Sorry. She's creeping through the castle, trying to steal into her foster father's offices to find whatever papers he's got surrounding the circumstances of her birth, because she was a foundling who was left outside the city gates. Let's see. Reaching the first set of steps, Ash risked looking back. Katia must have blown out the light, as Marifus' eye had bidden, for the space beneath the little maid's door was now dark. That was good, Ash told herself, moving her mind away from the subject. She didn't want to think about what might be happening within. Solid limestone steps muffled her footfalls as she descended the stairs. Brass hooks, mottled blue and orange with rot and rust, jutted from the stairwell like bird claws, forcing her to walk dead center. Once they had been used to suspend great fire-blackened chains that linked all the cask's portcullises to a single lever in the strong room below. Now, they were just one more hazard to avoid, like servants, brothers in the watch, and the raw mountain air. Ash rubbed her arms. She was so cold, freezing, yet she had thought to wear her thickest nightgown, and her feet were slippered in moleskin. It wasn't even winter yet, not properly, so why could she never get warm? You are not well, almost daughter. I worry. Ash shook her foster father's voice from her head. She wasn't unwell in the way he meant. Katia had told her all about what happened to girls when they came into their blood, and nightmares and cold sweats formed no part of it. You'll get stomach cramps, Katia had said, an air of vast superiority warming her voice, and your mind starts turning to men. Ash blew air through her nostrils. Men. No, that definitely wasn't happening to her. Something else was. 10 nights in a row, she had dreamed of ice. Always she awoke to find sheets damp with sweat twisted around her arms like rope. The dreams were so real, and the voices of the creatures who spoke to her were like nothing she had ever heard before. Mistress, they murmured, as sickly pleasing as sweet rolls spread with honey and jam. Come for us, stretch toward us, reach. So I'll stop there. But what I really love about that passage is just how sensory it is, and just how much each line within that passage is cast in Ash's thoughts. You've got all sorts of lovely little world-building details that are quite specific to the setting. So you know the castle she's creeping through, it's made of limestone. You can almost visualize the brass hooks that are all around her, impeding her passage. You can feel the way she's shivering as she's creeping through. And there's just all of these sensory details for me add to this overall kind of creeping dread. And you're really with her. It's quite visceral. And there's a lot of tension there, even though not a lot is actually happening on the page, right? It's just a girl up out of her bed at night, and she's just creeping through a hallway, but there's all this lovely tension, and that is entirely generated just by the way JB Jones has made her choices with what she puts on the page as her prose.
That was an excellent passage. The first thing I need to ask is, have you ever considered being in an audiobook, not narrator? You did a great job with that.
I do actually narrate my audiobooks for my kids' bilingual picture books, but outside of that, I have given some thought to narrating a petition, but I decided that one, my accent is kind of weird, and two, I've done a little bit of work onto just how much narrators have to put into doing the performance of the audiobook, and I calculated it would mean I would probably spend about 100 hours on the narration, which is 100 hours not writing the next book, and I figured people would probably want the next book more than they want to hear me narrating the book.
That's fair enough. We do want to know about the next book. And one more thing about JB Jones. I have not read Cavern of Black Eyes, although it's definitely on my TBR. But correct me if I'm wrong, that series is currently unfinished. And I know there's been a lot of pushback with fans who are kind of upset about that. Is that right?
Yeah, like, honestly speaking, the fact that it is not finished is not actually her fault. So as far as I've been able to follow, and JB Jones has been quite private, as is her right to keep these sort of things private, she had a very rough time, I think not long after the most recently published book, which was A Sword from Red Ice, came out. As far as I can gather from what she's posted on Patreon and in a couple of other places, her entire life basically fell apart. I think her marriage fell apart. I think she had to move from where she was to a totally different place. And so it's been very difficult for her in dealing with all of that. She is writing. She has been posting previews over on Patreon. And the thing that I never understood until I started writing myself is just how hard sequels are. I have been struggling so much with writing Supplicant. I cannot imagine how much of a struggle it is for JB Jones to be writing The Endlords, which I think is book 5 in the series. It was supposed to be, I think, the final book, but I think it is actually the penultimate book. There should be one more after that, which might be called a sword called Loss, I think. And so she publicly said on Patreon that she wanted, because obviously as an author, what you should see in an author's body of work as they publish successive books is you should see an improvement in the, it's hard to put the adjective objective before it, but I do think if you look at what an author is trying to do over their body of work, you should see an objective improvement in their prose and their storytelling, in their structure and their characterization throughout their career, right? You're always trying to get better with the next book that you put out. And so for her, I think she said it was very hard to, because she'd been out of practice of writing for so long, she actually had to go write a different book to kind of get her writerly muscles back in the swing of things before she flipped back to Endlords. And so the last I checked, she is in the middle of writing it somewhere. I'm not quite sure how far she is in the drafting process, but it is being worked on. It is coming. And from someone who loves the series, I would say if you like Robin Hobb, if you like really grimdark stuff, if you read A Song of Ice and Fire and you were like, there were not enough White Walkers in this series, you should try and pick up A Cavern of Black Ice and see if it is for you, because she's like, it is absolutely phenomenal. And there are so many powerful narratives in this story that it just gutted me. So do read it. She is working on the series. Do support her. Do buy her books. Because, yeah, it is an epic tale that she's telling.
Well, highest recommendation I think you can give, so I definitely will bump it up my TBR. But before we continue with some more prose, I want to give the chance to talk about your book and your series, Petition. So it was entered into the Spiffo competition. I have read it, and I absolutely loved it. So could you tell our audience members just a little bit about it, about the main character, and just maybe like the 2-minute like elevator pitch, so to speak.
Sure. So I typically pitch Petition as the daughter of the Empire. Oh my goodness, I can't speak. Daughter of the Empire meets the traitor Barry Cormorant in a cage match between empaths. And it is essentially the Immigrant story, but in an East Asian inspired fantasy setting. And a lot of the impetus for telling that story is it is my story. It is my story, the story of my friends, a lot of the story of my family and their families that typically I don't see depicted in fantasy. And that is changing now with a lot of diaspora authors now getting to have their books published and their stories being told. But at the time when I was growing up, like the closest representation that I ever found in popular media was like Claudia Kishi in The Babysitter's Club. That was it. And then I found Daughter of the Empire and I was like, oh my goodness, Lady Mara, I can relate to her so much. She is someone from who looks like me, who thinks like me, who is from a culture that is, while not exactly like mine, it is close enough to mine that for the first time I was reading that story and I was like, this is my life. Or this could have been my life if I were a different person, if I were in a different situation. And so a lot of my personal struggles and the struggles that my family had and that my friends and their family had went into the making of Petition. Because what is it like to try and uproot yourself from a place that, you know, you love and that you have generations of history going back, right, and culturally, and then you take all of that, you give up everything that you have, and you move yourself to a completely different place. And it's not, you know, on a whim or anything. It is because you genuinely believe that there is no future for you in your homeland, and you have to go somewhere else to make that new start. You have to go somewhere else, and you're drawn there because of this promise that in this new world, it doesn't matter who you are. It doesn't matter where you come from. If you work hard, you will succeed. You will find prosperity. You will have there's this golden promise, right? And so a lot of that was what went into Petition. And for those who like tournaments out there, I've worked a lot of I've spent a lot of years working in corporate accounting, and one of the things that always struck me as like completely nonsensical is the job hunting process. I know like the magic school trope is a very popular trope, but I personally had no interest in writing magic school because I was like, why do we have all these books telling the story of, you know, let's learn the magic, we're in school. And I'm like, but in real life, you know, school is such a small part of your experience. There is so much that happens that after that school process, when you're trying to find a job, my goodness, like I remember going through and trying to find my first job. It was just so much pressure trying to go through it. And so yeah, that's why I made it also a job hunt tournament.
Well, I know the feeling with corporate accounting. That's what I do for a living. So we can relate on that one. Excellent with Petition, and it's nice to hear the background story. And you also said that you are writing the sequel. Is there anything you can update the listeners podcast on, because I know I'm a fan of it?
Oh my goodness, the sequel, as I said earlier, I did not anticipate how difficult writing a sequel was, because I kind of did the thing where I was like, okay, I've never written a book before, I don't know if I can write a book, and it turns out I could. And then so I was like, oh, the sequel, this should be easy, I've got the world, I've got the characters, I've done this before, you know, all you have to do is do the same thing again but different. And I went into writing the sequel thinking, I had a very clear idea of what it was supposed to be. So Petition is about getting the job, and then Supplicant, the sequel, is about, okay, you've got the job, now what's next? So the book is focused on Rahilu as she goes and starts her new job, and she's on a mission. And it was supposed to be an 80,000 word novel. So Petition is roughly 115,000 words, which is it's decent for fantasy. You feel like you get just enough story, but it's not one of those, you know, crazy doorstoppers. And Supplicant, my intent was to do the same. So it was supposed to be Raheely for 80,000 words and then Lorne for 40,000 words as a subplot, because you kind of expect a storyline about him just from the way Petition is. Sadly, I started writing and I got to something like 130,000 words and I was like, oh, I am not done. Oh, this is not good. And so right now the draft for Supplicant has gone over 200,000 words, and it is just Raheely's storyline so far. I'm sorry to anybody who is expecting a Lorne story. That is going to have to wait until walkthrough, but we're close. I am in beta revisions right now, so that means I have gotten feedback from my beta readers, and I am now going through and addressing all of their comments to make sure that the places where they were confused, I need to clarify and add clarity. The places where they were like, what on earth just happened there? I need to make sure I've you know, gone back and set up the foreshadowing properly. And so the light is at the end of the tunnel. I'm hoping that we can get the book out this year. That would be really nice. But it has been a very difficult process. And I think part of it is because, again, coming back to the idea of being an author and wanting to get better with every single book you write, there are things that I can now look at that I go, oh, that's just not a good idea. You can do better than that. And part of it is not wanting to put out a book that you guys are not going to be happy with. So the work continues, and I'm hopeful that I can get it to you guys by the end of the year.
That's excellent news, and you don't have to apologize for giving us massive door stoppers. We like our doorstoppers over here. I think it'll look pretty good on the ship as well. And now to wrap up our talk discussion about prose, when someone, I guess, listening to this podcast or in the fantasy sci-fi community, when they hear the word prose, what's the first couple authors that come to mind? Obviously, Tolkien, definitely Patrick Rothfuss. I'd say even the newer ones like R.R. Verdi, who is very similar to The Name of the Wind. Jenny Wirtz is out there. But there's also a lot of great prose out there from authors who people have never heard about. My final reading, I'm going to talk to you guys about one that I absolutely love, but most people have never heard about. Was there an example of prose that you absolutely love from authors who are just not very well known or kind of under the radar, so to speak?
Oh, so many. Okay. I don't even know where to start. Oh, actually, I do know where to start because I've just realized I pulled out a book that you guys can't see on your screen. Tanith Lee. Tanith Lee has an amazing backlog. I have only ever scratched the surface of it. And the book I'm looking at now is To Cast a Bright Shadow, which is part of the Lion Wolf trilogy, which I could not find the copy. So that is why I have not continued with the trilogy. That's the only reason. But Tanith Lee, brilliant. Helen Lowe, she writes heroic epic fantasy. She's a New Zealand author. She's working on the last book of her trilogy. She's got a background in poetry. And so if you're looking for something that's like Tolkien, but with like a Song of Ice and Fire vibes in the world building, check out Helen Lowe. Simon Jimenez did something incredible in The Spear Cuts Through Water. And I don't know how, but it got passed over by all the award nominations in the year it qualified for them. But it is an absolutely brilliant book when it comes to the prose. There are very experimental aspects in there that, like, as an author, I sit there and I just go, I don't understand how, one, you came up with the idea, and then two, made all of these ideas work. Because not only does he have multiple concurrent timelines happening in the novel, he's also got second person, he's got some first person, he's got some third person, he's got third person omniscient. He basically, all of the POVs that you think of that can be used in a novel, he has used, but it somehow works. It is absolutely magical, and I cannot believe that This Fear Cuts Through Water was only his second book. Who else? Robin Hobb, but I think everybody knows about Robin Hobb. L.E. Motisit he's very interesting. He's also a writer that has a very strong prose style. And if you don't get on with it, you will not like his books, I don't think. But he, like, again, he writes, I would say, slice of life epic fantasy. That normally doesn't work for me. But the reason why his books do work for me is when he goes into the slice of life elements, he goes very deep into them in a way that I think it really brings it to life. It's not, you know, just character wandering around doing mundane things. It's character getting very deep in, you know, their particular craft and honing their craft. And again, like linking back in with a lot of the philosophical explorations that they have around the themes of the book. Who else? Sorry. There's just so many authors out there with fantastic prose. I think I'm going to end with Motisit.
Thank you for those suggestions. That was wonderful. And L.E. Motisit, I did read the first three books in his Imgur portfolio sequence. And I love those because they're very, it is slice of life. It talks about an artist and how he develops this Imgur magic, and I've never read anything like it. It's not for everybody. There's not like a lot of action. It's very political thriller. It's very like down to earth, but it just struck a nerve with me, and I just love that series. So with that, I'll talk about the final verse that I want to read. So this is from Ricardo Pinto, Stone Dance of the Chameleon series, the first book being The Masters. It is grimdark. So you need to like that in order to love this book. But this is a top five series for me because of the plot and the characters. But the prose just elevated to like another level. And it's kind of like hidden under the radar. Like you wouldn't think about the prose when you think about this book because there's so much going on. But the prose just take it to another level for me. And I just want to read the first few pages, and it's really short. So background for it. A son, his name's Carnelian, and his father, Sooth, are on like an isolated island, and they see a visitor ships coming on the horizon. So here we go. The gale rattled the shutters and slanted the sky with snow, but in the warm heart of the hold, Carnelian sat with some of his people around a fire. Those who could still remember told of their lives before the child gatherers came for them. Their stories bleached his mind with the light of summers far away. He narrowed his eyes against the leaping dazzle of the flames, and the tale rumbled on amid the whisper of women weaving, the remote clink and clatter from the kitchen, someone humming a song when the wind keened. He shivered and sank deeper into the comfort of his chair. A child's voice cried out, muffled, outside somewhere. Spell broke. Reddened faces turned from the fire. A gust of snow-spotted air lifted a tapestry as a girl entered through the great door. Carnelian rose with the others and drew his blanket around him. She ran towards them, all eyes and breathless. A boat. Her lips shaped the words with exaggerated care as she took delight in their looks of disbelief. He frowned. A ship? The girl jerked a nod. A ship, Carney. I swear, a ship. It's there on the sea. I saw it. He gave his blanket to someone, threw on his cloak, and offered her his hand. Show me. She reached up, sank her chin into her chest, and blushed. In Carnelian's white hand, her fingers were small and dark. They led a procession out from the hall. As the cold struck them, he sent the old back into the warmth. If it's true, I'll send word. He let the girl pull him across the slushy courtyard. Youngsters followed. They huddled against the wind that ballooned their blankets and ruffled the feathers of Carnelian's cloak. They crossed two courtyards to reach the halls that looked east over the sea. Pavilions, slender columned, in summer cooled by tiles and water and filled with sun and laughter, but now abandoned to the frost. When they reached the door to the tower, their ear tips burned, up steps treacherous with ice. They fought against the screaming wind. At the top, they girded themselves and staggered out into a raging roar. Snow flurries furred with their eyes. Carnelian leaned into the gale and pulled the girl after him. They clung to the parapet with numbing fingers. He held her as they squinted. The sea rolled its glass towards them, scratched with white. They felt each wave detonate on the shore. The girl grimaced up at him and shouted something. Her hand shook as she pointed. He saw only the mounding terror of the sea. The disappointment was crushing. His heart quickened. He saw a sliver of a ship with sails stretch open like fingered wings, flying towards them on the wrath of the storm. So that's just like the opening three pages. And every time I read it, it gets me every time that it's just such blush and beauty. It's such a simple few pages, but it's just the atmosphere and the deep tone and the tenor that he gives to it. That's just, it brings life to a world. And that's what I love about prose. It adds something beyond, it adds something onto the feeling and the atmosphere. Obviously it's words being said, but sometimes it's just like a feeling that you have when you step apart, like, wow, that's just beautiful.
There's so much that I think people mistake for the concept of prose, because typically, if you haven't given much thought about prose, like I used to be, you kind of associate prose with like, oh, it just means people who, you know, have a very large vocabulary and they have very flowery turns of phrase and things like that. But I think we've shown through this discussion with a lot of the passages that we've picked, you don't have to be, you know, pulling out the thesaurus or have very complicated constructions in your sentences to have great prose. A lot of these examples we've read use quite simple words, direct language, and it's less to do with picking like a difficult word. It's more about picking the right word and structuring the sentence in the right way so that when you read it, it is doing all those evocative things and it is almost like music. That for me is what makes great prose.
I couldn't agree more. And hopefully if you guys are listening to here and you agree that prose is something that it should be more prevalent in writing, share the word. Tell people that prose adds something more to writing than, okay, an extra battle or this massive dragon or, I don't know, this amazing character. It's just, it builds another layer to a story, and it makes it that much more enjoyable in my eyes. And hopefully, I didn't appreciate it when I was younger, but I absolutely do now. So, I don't know, maybe it's something that grows with time for every reader. I don't know. Maybe I'm an anomaly, but
I think you're right. It is one of those things where I think you definitely grow into the appreciation of it, because especially as you read more and as you read more diversely and explore authors with different styles and different genres and things like that, you start seeing that prose can be used to do more than just convey information. And especially for me, when I started looking at how authors with fantastic prose actually do prose, I really honestly encourage everyone to check out the Seth Dickinson article called Let's Hurt Sentences, because it is a amazing breakdown of how just changing the way that you write one sentence completely changes how you as a reader would perceive and experience that scene.
I absolutely couldn't agree more. And Delilah, this has been a fantastic discussion about prose and your stories and what we both take away and love about these types of stories. And I can't thank you enough for them. Could you tell our audience members where they might be able to find you, your social media handle, where they can find your book, Petition, and maybe a newsletter?
Absolutely. The best place to find me is at www.delilahwan. So that's D-E-D-I-L-A-H. Wait, hang on. I just spelt my name wrong. Oh, I can't spell. Sorry, guys. DELILAH1WAAN.com. That's my website. And on there, you'll find all of my social media handles. I'm on Twitter, Instagram, Reddit most often if you actually want to hear about what I've been reading lately and my opinion on books. And you can also subscribe to my newsletter at the bottom of my website. I send out one maybe once a month, and it's usually just two things: what I've been working on and what I've been reading.
Awesome. Can't wait to get my hands on the sequel to Petition. Hope I know it's going to be fantastic if it's anything from the first one. And I hope to have you back on to maybe discuss it in more detail.
Thank you so much. It's been great being here.
Okay. Thanks so much, and cheers, everybody.